So we are going to conclude our series on Ecclesiastes today. We had to take a break because of the stuff Ecclesiastes talks about happened to us. And I just want to give you a little update on that because this church has spent a ton of volunteer hours and resources helping out our neighbors and our neighborhood after the tornado happened. And I just want to let you know what's happening now. We're now going into phase two of that, which is because of all the work that this church and so many other people have done to respond to the needs of our community. This is kind of the fruit of that. This is over 300 families, over 1,000 people who have allowed us into their lives when they hit rock bottom. And so we're going to be following up with that. And I just want to tell you what I've seen as the preacher here for the last few weeks. I couldn't be prouder of the way this church has responded and the way that you have sacrificially given your time and run into the hard situations of life. So that's what we're going to be doing now. We have God-given opportunity to be able to minister to these families with no strings attached, just because this is who God is and what Jesus would have us do. So, with that said, let's get into Ecclesiastes. The problem with modern life for so many of us is that joy is really, really fragile. And if you listen to what Ecclesiastes is saying today, it can change your life and it can change your joy. Like, you can always have joy. There is a philosopher, one of the smartest guys I've ever read, named Albert Camus. Has anybody ever heard of Albert Camus? Okay, Albert Camus, brilliant guy. He was an existentialist. He said that basically the only question, the one really serious philosophical problem is suicide. That's what all philosophy really boils down to. Now, that may sound a little bit jarring, but let me tell you what he means. He means life is absurd. Life is just absurd. It doesn't make sense. People die young. People who are bad get away with murder. People who are, you know, trying to live noble and good, they often have great tragedy happening to them. Sometimes life is great. And sometimes it's awful. And sometimes when it's great, you're always worried about the next shoe dropping and it becoming awful. And yet, Camus says, why does this bother me so much? Because this is the way it's always been. It's not like this is a new problem. Life has always been absurd. Why does this bother us so much? So when I lost my faith, this is the thing that I got back first. When I lost my faith, before I believed that God raised Jesus from the dead, before I was an Orthodox Christian again, this is the thing that was the hardest for me to let go of in faith. Because here's what I realized about myself, and I bet you realize this too. I realized I couldn't shake the idea that I have, that life has a point. I couldn't just get to the point where I thought it was all just random molecules and human beings are just evolved pond scum. Now, I'm not saying that God didn't use evolution. I don't know how that worked. But we didn't just evolve to thinking that there was some kind of meaning and purpose to this life. If there is no meaning and purpose to this life, as far as I know of, we are the only species that thinks about this, that thinks about, why am I here? And here's the thing, I believe this not because I can prove it, not because you can prove it, but because I sense it. There's this disconnect between, for me and maybe for you, what I see in the world and the way the world is and what I expect the world to be. There is absolutely no reason for me to have this problem unless God put eternity in our hearts. And so the very thing that at first feels like an argument against God, if you chase it, is actually, I think, an argument for God and maybe even from God. Now, if you've been here the last few weeks, you've heard us go through Ecclesiastes, and Ecclesiastes sounds so punk rock today. But here's the thing. It's been saying this stuff for over 3,000 years. The things that the new atheists said long before they became like rock stars on college campuses and late night talk shows, Ecclesiastes has been saying for 3,000 years, and it's in your Bible. And Ecclesiastes is hard to understand. I mean, it seems kind of all over the place. It seems like a bunch of depressing fortune cookies just put into one little book. But if you pay attention to it, it is epic. So Christian preachers have been discovering Ecclesiastes over and over again throughout the centuries. Like John Wesley, he said basically what Ecclesiastes is trying to say is there is no happiness outside of God. And whenever your life gets frustrating, whenever you're disappointed, whenever it's not shaking out the way you wanted to, or whenever things falling apart, remember this. Remember what Ecclesiastes is saying. When you feel overwhelmed or you're tempted to wonder why you should even bother with your work or your relationships or with your faith, remember what Ecclesiastes is saying. The reason we have this kind of ache inside of us for the world to be different is because we were made for a different kind of world. A world that we believe is coming. So what does that mean? Well, it means from now that you live in relationship to this life, knowing that there is always going to be an itch in you that you can't quite scratch. And if you try to scratch that itch too much, you might find yourself addicted. You might find yourself in places you never would have chosen on your own. You can numb that itch, you can ignore it, you can mock it, but nothing will quite feel it. But there is a way to live in light of the kind of life we have that is actually quite kind of fulfilling and wonderful. But first, the bad news. Go to Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Remember, this is written as if it's Solomon, and Solomon is going to use all of his life resources, the power, the wealth, the connections that he has, to see if there is anything in life that can fulfill him. And the danger of not paying close attention to Ecclesiastes is that we don't have the resources Solomon had. So we'll always think that that the problem wasn't that I was chasing the wrong thing, the problem was it was the wrong relationship. And so if I just, that person was wrong, so if I just have another relationship, that'll fix it. The problem is that I don't have, you know, I just need a little bit more money, that I just need to try a little bit more. And we'll find ourselves, if we're not paying attention, not able to even come to Solomon's final conclusion, which is this guy slept with everyone. He built anything he wanted. He had all the money in the world. He ate and drank and pursued pleasure and education and all these things, and at the end of it, the only word he can use to describe it is meaningless. So here's what he says in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, starting in verse 12. Then I turned my thoughts. He's gone through all the, you know, I've slept with everyone, I've done, you know, I've had all the pleasure in the world. I think I'm going to try wisdom. So I turned my thoughts to consider wisdom, and also madness and the opposite of wisdom, foolishness. What more can the king's successor do than what's already been done? I saw that wisdom is better than foolishness. Just as light is better than darkness, the wise have eyes in their heads while the fools walk in darkness. But then I became to realize the same fate overtakes them both. Then I said to myself, the fate of the fool will overtake me also. What do I gain from being wise? This too is meaningless. For the wise, like the fool, will not long be remembered, and the days have already come when both have been forgotten. Like the fool, the wise man too must die. In other words, and this is bleak, in 1,000 years, people aren't going to know the names of Adolf Hitler or Mother Teresa. It doesn't make a difference what kind of life they lived. The only people that will know them are junior high kids studying history, and even then, they won't really know their lives. And if that's true of them, how much more is that true of me? The wise and the fool, and me and you, have the same fate awaiting all of us. And then he goes on. In Ecclesiastes chapter 2, going on in verse 17, "So I hated life, because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless. It's a chasing after the wind. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to one who comes after me. And who knows if that person will be wise or foolish." In other words, Solomon is saying, have you met my son-in-law? Now, yet they're going to have control over all the fruit of my toil into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. So my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labor under the sun. For a person may labor, and you may be good at your job with knowledge and skill, and then you have to leave it all to another who hasn't worked for it. This too is meaningless and a great misfortune. What do people get for all the toil and anxious striving with which they labor under the sun? All their days, their work is grief and pain, and even at night, their minds do not rest. This too is meaninglessness. Is he describing anybody else's days, and more particularly your nights? He hated work. And by the way, the stuff that he's doing is going to be, he built one of the ancient wonders of the world. And Solomon's saying, no matter what I did, no matter what I poured my life into, somebody else is going to inherit it. They're not going to appreciate it. And that's why he's saying life feels absurd, because we all die. And the stuff we do with our life, we tend to overvalue it when we're doing it. And it's not until hindsight that we realize this. And then, and this is where it starts to get good, y'all. Because all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Ecclesiastes says this. So, a person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their toil. And that thing I just told you that was awful. A person could do nothing better than that. This too I see is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? In other words, that thing I just told you that is meaningless, it's all meaningless, it's all vapor, it's all hevel, so we should probably enjoy it. It takes this unexpected turn that it does over and over again in the Bible, in Ecclesiastes, where it says, it takes this positive turn, and it's like, so you should enjoy it while you're doing it. Up until this point, he sounds like a workaholic who hates his work and has nothing to show for it. But then there's this theme that shows up over and over again, and the theme is joy. 24 times in the little book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon is going to talk about joy and how to find it. He has just said his work stinks. He just said not even the best food or drink could satisfy their soul. But now it can. Now he can find enjoyment in his work and in his food and in his drink. What's the difference? God is the difference. This is the first time God is mentioned in Ecclesiastes in a positive way. Up until this point, God was the problem. And now all of a sudden, Ecclesiastes is saying, listen, hold on. There's a way to live in relationship to this absurd thing that is life. It actually can be a source of great joy. Now, he's saying, if we're deeply dissatisfied, maybe one of the reasons is that we're taking the stuff that are good things and trying to make them ultimate things. Because any of those things, these good gifts from God, are fragile, they're temporary, and they can't scratch that itch. In fact, if you keep pursuing them, you will find what we call today the law of diminishing returns, which is it starts out great and then gets worse. In the language of the Bible, idolatry, or in the language of modern day, addiction. So look at how Ecclesiastes talks about this. In Ecclesiastes chapter 6, I've seen another evil, and this is the first mention of the word evil. I've seen another evil under the sun, and it weighs heavily on mankind. God gives some people wealth, possessions, and honor so that they lack nothing their hearts desire, but God does not grant them the ability to enjoy it. and strangers enjoy them instead. This is a meaningless and a grievous evil. A man may have 100 children. That was a good thing, by the way. A man may have 100 children and live many years, yet no matter how long he lives, he cannot enjoy his prosperity and does not receive proper burial. I tell you, a stillborn child is better off than he. It comes without meaning. It departs in darkness, and in darkness its name is shrouded. What's horrible, Ecclesiastes is saying, is to have all this goodness around you and not be able to enjoy it. Remember, Ecclesiastes is part of the wisdom literature. And wisdom literature, like we're going to talk about Proverbs in just a second. Proverbs is basically a manual for parents to pass on conventional wisdom to their kids. But Job is written to describe what happens when you lose everything you wanted in life. And Ecclesiastes is written, what happens when you get everything you wanted in life? And it's not enough. And human history tells us this plays out over and over again in the last stages of a culture. What tends to happen is a culture tends to be very, very successful and wealthy and prosperous and also miserable. This was true in ancient Rome, in ancient Greece, in ancient Israel, and it might be true today. Because we are so prosperous. We have all the amenities and comforts at our fingertips, and we've never been more likely to die from our own hand. Albert Camus had a point. In the absurdity of life, the only philosophical problem is life worth living or not? Ecclesiastes is trying to imagine a culture. So see if you can. Imagine a culture where people have anything they could want within reason, and yet they're unable to enjoy it. Imagine a culture where we're more secure and safe, as reasonably you can be, and yet we lie in bed at night, our minds are racing just like they did in prosperous ancient Israel. This is what makes Ecclesiastes so unique and why you should pay attention to it. Because it's wisdom after wisdom. Proverbs is what's written for teaching kids, like, look, this is how the world generally works, right? If you wake up early, you work hard, you'll probably do well in your job. You'll probably do well financially if you save more than you spend, if you set aside some stuff, if you choose how to choose your wife well or your husband well, or you choose that you're going to remain single. It's basically just conventional wisdom. It's A plus B equals C. But Ecclesiastes comes along and says, nope, that's not universally true, is it? There is a glitch in the system. Because, and some of you know this, some of you were faithful, and then your partner cheated. Some of you woke up early and worked out, and you ate the kale salads, and then you still got that diagnosis. Ecclesiastes is for the people who have bumped into the unfairness and absurdity of life. And I do think you have to have lost something before Ecclesiastes starts to make sense. We don't have that much control. Life is absurd. But it's going to get good, y'all. Since that's true, you should probably enjoy it while you've got it. The Ecclesiastes, it does not offer a lot of answers, but it asks the best questions. Questions that are better than any other questions I've ever found, and I've been looking. It identifies the problem of human existence. When you forget that you are not God, when you try to make your own existence, you are setting yourself up for despair. And if that's hard to believe, then you can keep going. You'll just get there eventually. And what Ecclesiastes is saying is that the trick to this absurd, meaningless life is to receive this life that we have very little control over as a gift from God, and everything in it as gifts from his hands. So here's the way one commentator talks about Ecclesiastes. He says, it's important not to make one of these claims the only message of the book. Like, it's meaningless. Enjoy your life. But both at the same time, Ecclesiastes insists on both and often in the same passage. This is the wisdom after wisdom. Yes, life is hard and difficult and absurd and sometimes bleak, and yet joy is everywhere if you have eyes to see it. And since it's so vapor-like and fragile, and since it's so absurd and we don't know, you know, when the March 31st tornadoes were going to happen, you can be happy and content in your home one day and the next it's not standing. Since life is like that, you should probably enjoy it while you've got it. This is not a message of despair. This is a message of how to live with God at the center of your life. So in his book, Into the Thin Air, John Krakener tells a story about how he and a team of people climbed to the top of Mount Everest. And how it was a dumpster fire. Because 8 men on their team died trying to summit Mount Everest. And after a few days of exhausting conditions, broken ribs by John, and just eating a bunch of M&Ms, he finally stands on the top of Mount Everest, and here's what he says in his memoir. I understood on some dim, detached level that the sweep of Earth, because he's looking at Tibet and China and Nepal all at the same time. I understand it was a spectacular sight. I'd been fantasizing about this moment and the release of emotion that would accompany it for months. But now that I was finally actually there, standing on the summit of Mount Everest, I just couldn't summon the energy to care. And then he goes on to say, under the circumstances, I was incapable of feeling anything except cold and tired. It is possible to reach the top of your life, both professionally, metaphorically, and to find you've become so successful. You're easier to hate than imitate. Only to discover that when you get to the top, you don't really care. And you'll find that when you get there, for the most part, the price you paid to get there isn't worth being there. And that's why Ecclesiastes is written. I'm talking to a lot of mountain climbers. And I want to tell you, you're not going to find what you're looking for there. Maybe you need to experience that for yourself. But if you have eyes to see, there's plenty to work with down here. I am sick of cynicism. I'm sick of it. For the last 300 years, it's been the mood in the West. And there's a lot of philosophical reasons, and it is a philosophy that has got ahead of steam. But the way you experience it is you walk into a room, and the cynic is the person. Maybe it's you, maybe it's someone else. But you're the person who's automatically seen as the smartest person in that room. People are like, oh, wow, they have opinions. And, you know, it can be anything. It can be like all preachers stink or Netflix is just derivative nonsense or whatever it is. But when the cynic speaks up, everybody in the room kind of shuts down because they're seen as the wisest person in the room. But here's the thing about cynicism. Cynicism always presents itself as wisdom. And it's almost always rooted in a wound that they're not talking about. And it makes the move, cynicism makes the move from some to all in a way that's not logical or truthful. So for example, all politicians are corrupt. All preachers do it for the money. All religion is just wish fulfillment. As if you could possibly know that. And the problem with cynicism, and this is where Ecclesiastes is so great. Ecclesiastes pushes back on the bully that is cynicism. That's like, oh, come on. You're lazy. The problem with your cynicism is that you're not going far enough. You're just dipping your pool in the bleakness that is the absurdity of life. It's way worse than that. Ecclesiastes says to the cynic, it's way worse than that. We're all gonna die. You think Paramount Plus is a scam? You think that's a pyramid? It's way worse than that. We're all gonna die. And then it invites us into joy. And it's the kind of joy that cannot be shaken by the absurdity of life. Because there's a kind of joy that says joy's not happiness. Happiness is based on that word, that happenstance. So, you know, it just goes up and down based on what's going on in the moment. There's a kind of joy that has room for anger and betrayment and honesty, that does not repress, that does not pretend, that does not deny. It has room for all of it. So I want to show you how Ecclesiastes is talking about this. So a few months ago, my wife Leslie took our 8-year-old to Mills Park in Bryant to fly some kites. And they're having a lot of fun, and then all of a sudden a couple of 18-year-old boys came up with some soccer balls, and they were just like kicking them around, and Joel loves soccer, so he ran over and started kicking the soccer ball with these two 18-year-old boys. And so Leslie goes over and joins them. And so kicking the soccer ball around for like 5-6 minutes. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Joel, our 8-year-old, yells out at the top of his lungs, "My mom's single!" Leslie's like, No, I'm not. I'm actually happily married. I'm not. Well, what could she say? At this point, there's nothing you can do but just be like, "Let's go, yes." Because now she looks like she's some kind of cougar on the prowl that she's using this 8-year-old boy for bait. And I tell you that because our family has not stopped laughing about that. And I have so much more material like that to share with you. And here's what I'm trying to tell you. If you want joy, lower the bar. It is all around you. You have this one and only God-given life. You have this driver's license and a job. And you know, whatever it is you do, you wake up in the morning and you go to work or you do something. You get dressed. You do what you do. There is a joy that says everything's fine even when it isn't. There are moments when everything is right with the world, even when it isn't. Now, this is not new to me. I heard a preacher say this years ago, and it changed my life. Because here's the thing. I have a job, and I bet some of you have jobs like this, that, you know how the world works. Like, everybody has like acquaintances, you know people, and then you have like a circle of closer people that you're friends with, and then you have like your inner circle. These are the people that know you and love you and care for you, and you care for them. Well, when tragedies happen, because when I started working in ministry, I was like 22 years old. I was working at the Hills, this really big church in Fort Worth. And one of the things about this job, and again, I think there are people in this room who have jobs like this, is one of the things about these kind of jobs is when tragedies happen, you just go straight through all those circles into the very middle. And you get to see what's going on in people's lives. And the absurdity of it. And the heartbreak. And the tragedy. And so, I'm like 28 years old when I do my first funeral for a baby. And my mentor tells me, "You need to get there before everybody else so you can get acclimated to seeing the casket. Because it's really jarring and disturbing. And you want to be able to do the funeral in a way that honors both the baby and the family." And so I do this. And at the time, we had a brand new baby. I think about this little boy named Jace, who was a 3-year-old who died in a car wreck in Abilene. And getting invited into that moment and doing that funeral that was just so heavy and holy. And then going home to my 3-year-old boy who wants to play Legos and wrestle. Over and over again, I had this thing where would be invited, I'd get a front row seat into other people's agonizing experiences that people go through in life. And then I go home to this. This is my our family, if you could put that picture up. This is our family of five. Of five kids. Leslie's included too. I'd go home, I'd have that experience, and then I'd go home to this. And trying to figure out how do you navigate that and this? How do you live in a world, keep going through those other two pictures, how do you live in a world with so much of both of those things? How do you live in a world where you know that could happen at any moment? So what happened is, and this is again the advice of Ecclesiastes, you learn to live wisdom after wisdom, which is the kind of way that those two things don't compete with each other. They inform each other. And since you've seen how easy it is for things to break, you might as well enjoy it while you have it. There's a kind of lightness that's common in our world today, especially in like pop culture and media, where, you know, we just talk about the happiness and the young and the, you know, all that. I'm not talking about that. Ecclesiastes is not talking about that. Because after lightness, after you, you know, live a little, there's a heaviness to life. But there's a lightness after that heaviness if you keep going. There's a lightness that says, yes, this whole thing can break our hearts. And yet, we should probably enjoy it while we have it. Brené Brown has done a lot of really great work. She's a sociologist, and she said in all of her research with people, the most terrifying emotion is joy. And the example she uses is, she heard this over and over again, a young parent would go and watch their child sleeping. And when they were looking at their child sleeping, they would have, their heart would fill up with joy, and then the very next thing was, what if? And so they would shut it off. Ecclesiastes is saying, don't shut it off. There's a sacred, vapor-like, fragile experience that you are getting to live right now. And since you know how heavy it can get and how quick it can go sideways, you might as well enjoy it while you have it. So this is what that looks like for me. It looks like when I want to pass my love of Superman on to my kids. It looks like I plan the 1979, obviously, Superman movie. And I put on my Superman uniform, not costume, uniform, and my kids. And I've done this for every single one of them. And when Superman saves Lois Lane in the helicopter, I teach them both how to jump the way Christopher Reeve did and land. And then they don't say nonsense later about Spider-Man being their favorite. This is what joy looks like for me. In the middle of all these heartbreaking things, what joy looks like for me is that when my Indian brother Simran is in town and he puts a turban on my dad, I take a picture, because this is the first time in human history a man named Cletus has worn a turban. Here's what joy looks like for me. It's when you go to the Mexican restaurant with your best friend, you tell him quietly it's his birthday, even though he doesn't want it. It's when you go to your wife's 40th birthday, you make sure you go to Mexican and you make sure they know it's her birthday. A lot of this involves hats, I'm realizing. So it's when you realize that you're sitting on a plane next to Tyreek Hill's mom. You don't care about nerding out. You take out your phone and you ask lots of questions, because your little kids are gonna lose their minds, even if the plane thinks you're creepy. So joy is when your family is playing, or actually, hold on, let's do this one next.
When you get offered a chance to drive a fire truck, even though you can't drive a normal truck well, you say, "Yes, sir, I would like that." Joy is when you get offered to dress up like a fireman, even when a lot of parents have their phones out and are taking pictures for social media, and you know it's going to look like that. You say, "Yes, sir, because I'm going to be a hero for my six-year-old." Joy is when you get just the right present at Christmas and your son loses his mind. You step back and take a picture because you want to savor this moment. This is what Ecclesiastes is saying. You can get good at this. Yeah, it's bad. Life is heavy and heartbreaking and fragile, and the cynic only dips their toe in this. Ecclesiastes is like, it's way worse than that. We're all going to die. So we should probably enjoy it while we've got it. Amen. This whole thing is hanging by a thread. So we should probably enjoy this sacred, fragile thing that is life. And you should reframe. Because what is heaven but eternal life? And imagine the evil that Ecclesiastes is picturing. Being surrounded by goodness and not being able to enjoy it. If you got more of that forever, that wouldn't be heaven. That would be hell. And Ecclesiastes is saying, you can get good at this. It does not come from ignoring the world as it is. It comes from accepting it and enjoying it anyway. And this is the best evidence of God that I know of. Joy. It's what Paul does. When the Apostle Paul, when he's planting a first church outside of the Jewish world, he doesn't start with Moses or the Old Testament. Instead, he starts with their supper time. He says to these people who just tried to worship him in Acts 14, he's like, there's only one God worthy of worship. In Acts 14, he says this, if you could put that up. In the past, God let all the nations go their own way, but he has not left himself without testimony. Go to the next slide. He has not left himself without testimony. He has shown kindness. He has given evidences. How? By giving you rain from heaven. And seasons with crops. And he provides you with plenty of food and fills your hearts with joy. With seasons and those good meals around tables with people you love and trust. And the laughter and the pangs of joy. You might as well enjoy it while you got it. And realize these are gifts from God. So back to Albert Camus. Albert Camus actually decided he was going to try Christianity. He started talking to a Methodist pastor in France. And he actually told him he would like to be baptized. It's the only thing that could make sense of life for Albert Camus. But he wanted a few more weeks to think about it. And this is not like a strong evangelistic call, but it is what happened. A couple of days later, he died in a car wreck. The absurdity of life that Albert Camus was so profoundly aware of got him before he could give his life to the Lord. And I like that. I don't like the way that played out, but I like Albert Camus because he chased the absurdity of life to its very end. And at the end of his life, he was about to find meaning under the sun. And I just want to say that to you. Say to the cynic inside of you and outside of you, don't believe it. It's way worse than that. We're all going to die. But there is meaning in this one and only God-given life. There is joy that comes from God. And so this is the way Ecclesiastes ends. In light of the way the world is, and yet all the joy that's in it. Now that all has been heard, fear God and keep His commandments.
For this is the duty of mankind.